Gary and Beverly Sweeney. Good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for putting in your submission, which we've read, so you don't need to read that out to us. Sounding like a broken record, I suppose, but you're very welcome to speak to and highlight the key points. I just want to be sure who's coming before who has.
Okay, thank you. I'll just give a rough bit of a spiel and a few points, and then Bev will tell you a little bit about us, and then I'll speak to the submissions we had there.
Yep.
As I said, we're Bev and Gary Sweeney at Moreton Mains, and we live on a support block on Mill Road North. Before I give a description of our operation and ourselves, I'd like to make some comments on yesterday and today that we've seen so far. I came into this venue yesterday to get some insight into other people's submissions. I spent a good 2 hours listening to 4 to 5 farmers speak on their setups, their business and their operations. Without exception, they were all really passionate and proud of their piece of this paradise. Also, it came through very strongly that already they are going to huge efforts to improve their land management, water management, stock management, etc. without regulation. I attended the Fed Farmers AGM back in mid-May, and the water scientist speaker there told us the water samples taken over many sites around Southland were encouraging, his words. He said, take the last 10-year window and the water quality had improved slightly. If you narrow that window to the last 5 years, the water quality had improved significantly more. Maybe what yesterday's farmers and today's farmers and ourselves are already doing are contributing to these results. I hope so. We'll be able to just read a spiel about ourselves.
Right, we are Gary and Bev. Gary's 63, me 62. We were married in 1975. We have 3 adult children and 3 wee grandsons. We both come from dairy farming stock, going back to the turn of the last century. Gary's 2 brothers and my 3 sisters are all dairy farmers. Guess what the topic is around the Christmas table? It's a sign of the times that none of our 3 children are involved in dairy farming. And of our parents' combined 20 grandchildren, 3 are dairy farmers. We bought our first dairy farm of 48 hectares in 1979 and, looking for adventure, moved south in 1993 to the Moreton Mains property of 210 hectares that we own today. We moved off that property in 2007 into a new home on our 70 hectare support block on Mill Road North. Along our Southland journey, we have owned 3 dairy farms and a large support farm, but these days are enjoying a well-earned retirement with 50-50 sharemilkers operating our sole remaining dairy farm. In 2014-15, we signed a contract with Advanced Cow Barns of Winton to construct a 632-bed free-stall barn, also incorporating open-plan calving bays and with rubber matting throughout. The complex includes 2 large concreted silage bunkers with any leachate and water runoff collected and pumped to the lined cow barn storage pond. The barn effluent is automatically scraped to drop pits at the end of the barn, flowing into a high pond before going through a solid separator. The separated green water is pumped to the storage pond and the solids are contained within the silage bunker solids bunker system. The barn is utilised 95% of the time for wintering the dairy herd, with the remaining 5% during the milking season when weather events threaten soil and pasture damage and animal welfare.
Okay, so refer back to the submissions. Rule 23. Intense and winter grazing. Comments on our submission. Define and get more specific on what is meant by intensive winter grazing. Now, in our submission, we've said to exclude grass as fodder. We note in the last year or so that a number of farmers are using grass and baleage combined as a winter crop. So grass in this situation is being used as intensive winter grazing. The exclusion of grass as fodder in the months of May, August and September will still allow us to manage the cows and the farm without being too restrictive. So hence you've read the submission there on the reasons why we would like that excluded.
Do you mind if I just ask you, have you had a look at the what's called the Section 42A report, which is the recommendations of the officers to us? Have you seen that?
No.
So what I can do is tell you, in terms of the two issues that you raise in your submission, the officers are recommending to us that the definition of intensive winter grazing does not cover the grazing of pasture, so it would meet your concern specifically. And your second submission point, you were concerned about Rule 38 and the period between May and September. That was in Rule 38D, Clause 1V. They've also recommended to us the deletion of that clause.
Right.
So the two issues that you've submitted on, the officers have recommended that we do exactly what you're asking for.
Well, we're quite happy with that.
I thought you might be.
Okay.
It's only a recommendation.
Right.
Just bear that in mind, but that's the state of play at the moment.
Okay. Well, we've got that covered. There's another area I'd just like to cover, and I'm not sure, we thought we sent a submission in, but I'm not sure, and that's Appendix P, Effluent Pond Drop Test Methodology.
Yeah, you did. You had two submissions. One was typed up and one was handwritten. So, yeah, we've seen both of those. But, so you're welcome to talk to that, or so I'll let you know about those other ones.
Okay. Some quite comments here. It's not actually defined then there whether we actually have to have our own equipment to monitor the pond level, or whether someone comes out and actually installs equipment there so the readings can be taken over a 48-hour period. Number four there, it says the data analysis is undertaken by a party independent of the equipment installer. So is someone doing the round installing their own equipment over this test period, or do us as farmers have to have our own equipment? Any change in pond fluid level over the test period needs to be accounted for. Now this is going to be extremely difficult because most ponds, as in a dairy cow shed, will be added to every day. So I'm not sure how you equate pond rising levels or falling levels to allocate into which area. Number six, ponds must be at or over 75% of the design depth before a test can be undertaken. Well, when the level is 75% full, we should all be, if not trying, to empty those ponds.
Yeah.
And I understand the reason why you want it 75% full, but the practical side of it tells me they should be being emptied at that level. The pond has to be desludged in the 12-month period prior to the test undertaken, and there shall be no sludge or crust on the pond surface during the test. It's no problem to us. Our pond has a solid separator before it, so there is no sludge on the top. But for those people pumping directly to a pond from any cow shed or any wintering shed, there will be sludge on the top of that pond, guaranteed. So I'm not sure how you get around that one.
Yeah.
And lastly, the wind speed not exceeding 10 metres per second during the test. This is Southland.
Yeah.
We're classed as coastal. You know, 48 hours without a wind speed, how do we get compliant with all those conditions there? There's probably an hour window when all the above conditions are met. Just more equipment with more cost, that will fail over time. That is not needed when we in particular have a lined pond which has drains underneath this pond, so you've got an overflow underneath it, right around the outside through the centre, that actually drain to an inspection port. That inspection port can be inspected 24/7, 365 days of the year, irrespective of the weather conditions or whatever. You cannot beat that system. Nothing technical involved, just setting it up in the first place. 100% foolproof. So basically, yeah, there's Appendix P to me is, has to be majorly changed.
Yeah. And look, just in terms of that, we certainly acknowledge the concerns you've expressed. You're not the only people to express those concerns to us about the drop test. And I've said this many times before, and I'll probably say it again, but we certainly don't want to have a plan that's impractical or just can't be worked with. And we also acknowledge the point you've made that if you have a modern lined pond with an inspection port in it already, then that really does the job, doesn't it? So we understand that submission as well. Is there anything else you'd want to add before we ask you questions, if we have any?
You may cover them in your questions, but we do have the test of the nutrient values from the solids, from the solid separator, and the liquid from the pond, if you're interested in those at all. Hence, they're applied. The solids are taken out and applied when basically favourable conditions allow, as well as the liquid effluent on the pond. Although the last year with all the rain, we actually had to take 1.2 million litres off the top of the storage pond. Otherwise, it would have flowed over the side. So that was done in August, basically with an umbilical system. But hence, we've had the test done of what's involved there.
Yep.
So we know application rates and things like that.
Okay. See if the panel would like to see that, and if they do, they'll let you know. But see if we have questions for you, Maurice.
Right. Thank you. Yes. further to Mr. Chairman, what you talked about the rule, the change to Rule 38, so the bit about not being able to apply it in the winter has been taken out, as recommended anyway. I mean, as you say, it's not final, but that's what's recommended. But it still can't apply it when the soil moisture exceeds field capacity.
Right.
That stays in there. So I wanted to ask, and I have asked other people this too, how can that be determined? But in your particular situation, and you've got experience with others as well, how can that the non-exceedance of the soil moisture capacity be determined so you know that you can apply for it safely?
Last year when we needed to empty the pond, of course it's fairly obvious when it gets reasonably close to the top that you have to do something about it. So you've got to act in good time. So you've got to preempt what's going to happen. I actually rang and spoke to Simon Knapp about it. And he said, basically, your consent's cover. You can actually take some off your pond, but common sense prevails, basically. So you put it on your dry paddocks,
nice.
Not when it's raining, but basically. So really, it's just common sense. And certainly those guys did it in August, to say 1.2 million litres off the top. And you couldn't see where they've been. It's just an umbilical system, if you understand those systems. And it's just pumped from the pond right down. Basically, we had it to the back of the farm to the dry paddocks, and they go around. It's like a big seed aerator, if you like, except there's liquid and comes out, and it's about this far off the ground. It's just dribbled around and around there.
Yeah.
And
you couldn't see where they'd been.
You couldn't see where they'd been.
It wasn't dirty looking or anything.
So in answer to your questions, really, ground conditions dictate. You can say, well, do you work off a temperature of 5 degrees and up because grass starts growing above that, basically? Mm. It's a combination of all those, but common sense, I think, probably is the biggest one.
Mm. I mean, we had no choice. It had to come out. We had to drop it.
Yeah. All right. And the one about winter grazing that the Chairman's brought up as well, and grazing on pasture. Are there some situations where winter grazing on pasture could have adverse effects that similar to grazing on forage crops or swedes, for example? Or is it a much safer method to use?
There again, I've got to be very careful what I say here because it doesn't affect us, because we have the barn situation.
Yeah.
But as long as ground conditions are dry, both fodder crops and grass are very, very successful, no problem with that whatsoever. It's only in adverse weather when both systems you have issues.
You can have, yeah.
I'm not sure why they've gone the grass way, because there's an awful lot of baitage out in those paddocks, but it looks to be reasonably successful at this stage.
And so you don't think it, I don't think, well, you say the adverse effects could occur, but generally less likely to, with the grass and baitage system.
Well, grass would, if it's down, grass would definitely operate as a better filter than what probably a fodder bed crop or a swede crop would. Mm. So grass would actually filter what's going down through it probably a lot better. So I think grass probably would have a less effect in that respect than what a fodder crop would have, okay. My opinion.
All right, thanks very much.
No questions from me, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Gary, do you think that the plan should actually reflect the differences between lined and unlined pond as far as the rules are concerned?
I think clay-lined ponds should be totally outlawed. They should not be allowed to be installed full stop.
Can I, through you, Mr. Chairman, to the officer, I'm just wondering whether in the reply that we could have differentiate between lined, as indicated by Mr. Sweeney, unlined, which is an earth pond, even if it's packed, weeping wall, some of those weeping wall systems are effectively an earth containment area. And sediment traps, there seems to be some commentary around the size of sediment traps and whether it's captured by a drop test or not. I'd appreciate that, thank you. No questions from me, Mr. Chairman.
And no further questions from me either, thank you very much.